You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show number 29. It is April 1st, 2019. Yes, indeed, the April Fool's edition on this Monday of the In the Money Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatal, back with you in the Brooklyn bunker once again after a month of peregrinations around the globe. Well, not really, just London, a little Manchester, back to London and Long Island. But very happy to be back in the bunker, back in Brooklyn today. And I am joined by a man who is nobody's fool. He is the people's champion, Jonathan Kinchin. What's up, JK?
What's going on, PTF? Haven't been a champion in a long time. I forgot what it's like to win something. I need to remind myself quickly.
Does that mean that your adventures in Chicago at the Hawthorne Invitational did not go well this weekend?
Well, they were a win. We did have some victories. We got some pancakes for Austin. That was a victory. We got ice cream for Austin, Shirley Temples for Austin. What else do we get? We got a free ride from our buddy Mike Mulvihill, dropped us off at the airport on the way home.
Very cool. A lot of
good things happened, but we did not do well in the contest, no.
No paramutual joy. Did you see my latest piece about Benny South Street and his drink of choice? Did you notice that in the last piece?
No, I haven't seen that. What is his drink?
His drink of choice is a dirty Shirley Temple, which is basically a regular Shirley Temple with a shot of bonded rye in it, which is a very Benny thing to drink, I think.
I thought it was like a Shirley Temple with olive juice in it.
Now that's truly foul. He insists it's good. He's just like, it's a highball with a little grenadine. What's wrong with that? I guess he once saw a kid drinking it, thought it looked good, wanted one, thought it needed a little more octane. And, you know, that's why Benny is Benny. He did a pretty nice job on those trip notes for the Florida Derby card over on the In the Money podcast blog. Gosh, we have so much to talk about, JK. We've got program announcements. We've got old races to talk about. And we've got some production meeting in the middle of the show / exciting announcements for listeners. I'm going to let you produce. Where should we start?
Let's start with the thing I'm kind of the most excited about. Let's talk about Friday night in Lexington.
It's going to be great. I'll start with that. Very excited to announce our partnership with Keeneland for the spring meet. We're going to be doing some extra podcasts for them. They will be under their own banner, production meeting in the middle of the show. Have we decided on a name for these shows?
I don't think we have. Crushing Keeneland with two Ks?
I don't know. That's 1K short of trouble. We might have to come up with something else. But I think what we might do, first of all, props to Keeneland. You know, we accidentally stole the name of their podcast, and yet they still wanted to do business with us. So that's pretty special and cool. And basically what it's going to be, we're not going daily for Keeneland. That it could, if this all works out, maybe that's a model down the line. But we're going to be doing a couple of shorter, typically, shows that focus on one day of action. So my thought was, the middle of this week, we do some evergreen content previewing the meet and take a quick look at Thursday and Friday. Then Saturday, Keeneland, we're going to cover on the regular late week In the Money Players podcast. Then Sunday, we'll come back once again with maybe a 20-minute show, just looking at like the late pick four at Keeneland. And it will be named. It will have its own name. It will appear in this feed, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And we're very excited to work with Keeneland and Keeneland Select. In a lot of ways, kind of a dream come true, really.
You know who I'm excited to see run on Sunday? If everything I've heard is true, I think this is going to be the 3-year-old debut of Newspaper of Record.
Is that right? That's fantastic. And it might require some changing travel plans for me. I wasn't sure if I was going to stick around Sunday or not, but obviously very much worth sticking around to see Newspaper of Record run. And that's probably the answer to one of the questions I was going to ask you, or might ask you still in one of these upcoming Keeneland podcasts. What race are you looking most forward to, or who's a horse you're most looking forward to seeing run at Keeneland, JK?
That's the Appalachian, right? Didn't someone say, isn't there like a joke about that? There's a right and wrong way to say Appalachian. Maybe Nick Tamaro told me that Kurt Becker let him know it's not the Appalachian. It's the Appalachian.
Appalachian.
When you're in Kentucky, yeah.
I'm very glad that saved me another debacle. Those Keeneland folks, we know their stickers for pronunciation, Alcibiades, Alcibiades, Alcibiades. It should be a lot of fun this weekend. And that sounds right, because last year it was Rushing Fall made the debut in the equivalent spot. This year, Newspaper of Record, supposedly a tilt at Ascot, potentially on the cards. We will see. I don't think anything's official in that regard yet, but boy, what an amazing story that will be to follow throughout the year. Let's hope she gets back to the races and in good form. But I tilted from where you originally brought this conversation. We are going to be kicking off Friday night at Bell's in downtown Lexington after the races, so approximately 6:30, 7 o'clock, and there's no cover. Come on down. We're going to have a little presentation with Jake Ballas of Black Type Thoroughbreds and also professional horse player Mike Maloney, author of Betting with an Edge, and you and me, and we're going to talk through some races, talk through some angles, have a few adult beverages. Does Bell's have food? Can we have some snacks too?
I don't think they do. They no, I don't think they have food. Not that I'm aware of. But if I had to vote, the vote would be no food.
Well, whatever. So we'll that probably means the program will be a little shorter, and then we'll walk down the block and go see Jenny at the Village Idiot. It'll be great.
It's right around the corner from the Village Idiot. That won't be a problem at all.
We can definitely get some food there. Getting table space Friday night at Keeneland could be an issue. But anyway, we'll eat heartily at the track, have a snack, come down and join us after the races. That's going to be a lot of fun. We might also be doing something at that event in benefit of the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, who are actually bringing you this show today. And I just keep encouraging people. Folks have had a little bit of luck lately following our tips and asking us, giving us props. We don't ask much. We love the props, of course. But hey, if you ever hit something big off something we say, or if you're just feeling generous and want to support the show, the link that we want you to donate, trfinc.org/players, then we get the credit for it. Makes us look good, makes everybody feel good. Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation doing great work for decades now with humans, with horses, and it's an organization that I know we both support heartily. Isn't that right, JK?
Absolutely. Anytime we have an opportunity to give back to these equine athletes and also the human athletes from time to time, it's always something that I definitely support.
All right, so keep your eyes on the feed, and if you're going to be in Lexington, if you can make it to Lexington, come join us Friday night after the races at Bell's downtown. If you have any questions about any of this stuff, hit us up. You can either go to inthemoneypodcast.com, leave a comment there, or you can hit us up on Twitter, at LoomsBoldly here, at UTBigHair there. All right, let's get the tough stuff out of the way. You good with that?
Tough stuff out of the way.
So, racing returned to Santa Anita. There was this very unfortunate news about another equine fatality. To my surprise, this made national news once again. And I don't want to sound like insensitive. This is one of these conversations. It's just so awful to have, but it's my belief that just being honest is the best policy when it comes to this stuff. And if the goal for racing is to never have another equine fatality, and like, if that's the goal, full stop, that's the goal we should be working towards. The same way that it's good sometimes to have, you know, my goal might be to I don't know, win the New York City Marathon. I'm not going to win the New York City Marathon. By trying to win the New York City Marathon, I'm probably going to run a lot better marathon than if my goal was to run a 4.5-hour marathon. In the same way, the goal of never having a fatality is a good goal that should be pushed towards, that will probably make us a better sport. However, if that's the goal, full stop, I got some bad news. You can't have racing without some equine fatalities. And it sounds awful to ever say there's an acceptable amount of fatality, but I think in the same way that we all love our pets, you know, I'm a massive dog lover. We got Muggs, the handicapping Labrador, right here beside me, as she is most every show. She sleeps in the bed with us. We love her. She's a member of the family. the same way that we accept having pets, even though we know the byproduct of unfortunately having pets, dogs and cats, is the breeding accidentally and sometimes intentionally of too many, where you get in a situation where a number of animals are either going to be mistreated or unfortunately put down in various ways. It's very ugly. We don't like to think about it. It is a really unfortunate byproduct of having dogs and cats. To me, with pets, the joy that the pets bring is worth the awful stuff, in much the same way that the awful, the, what racing brings, what racing gives us as human beings. I mean, it's, I mean, I guess it doesn't sound great when I say it out loud, but it's how I feel. It's acceptable to have a certain amount of fatalities. It, if we didn't feel this way, the only other alternative would be to go completely to the other side and say racing has to go, pets have to go, we have to phase them out, we have to get to a point where there can be none of this dark stuff happening. I just don't believe that's the world that we want to live in. It's nuanced, it's complex, it's ugly, just like life itself in a lot of ways. But I am okay with trying to make it better, but understanding that making it better doesn't mean it's never going to happen. If that's the standard we set for ourselves, JK, we've already failed.
Yeah, it's an impossible goal to be immortal in this sport, right? It's just not going to happen. It's just the nature of the animal, the nature of the beast, I guess, is what it is. Now, I agree. It's, if the goal is for to eliminate it totally, we have to do a whole lot of different things, and different things we would have to do to eliminate it totally would probably eliminate it totally, right? The racing as a whole, not just
agree. Actually, I don't think you could ever eliminate it totally. I mean, you hear stories about horses in paddocks just being turned out, find ways to get themselves in trouble. We once had a guy with some breeding experience on this show, and he said that a lot of what you're doing when you're taking care of a racehorse is keeping them from killing themselves. Like, they're, the idea of zero fatality, to me, it is not realistic. Do you disagree, apparently?
No, I don't think that it's not. No, I don't think that it can be solved. My point is that if that's the goal, you'd have to change so many things in racing that it wouldn't be racing. Right. You know, you would never want to fully extend a horse. You would, you know, you would just have them kind of gallop around there, or gallop and racing and not, you know,
I see what you're saying.
To eliminate it fully, you'd have to change the whole.
And it wouldn't even work. I mean, and the key part is it wouldn't even work. You'd still have fatalities under these circumstances, and you'd lose what was great about the sport in a lot of ways. Now, I'm not some vigorous defender of the whip or anything. Again, for a long time, I've been in favor of changing whip rules, and I've been talking about that on this show for years, so I have the documents to back that up. It's not that I'm against that stuff, but when you put these things forward in like a haphazard way, as if they're the answer to this other question, that's just dishonest and not correct and setting yourself up to fail. I'm sorry, I hijacked your conversation.
No, I completely agree. I think it's definitely something that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, there's been people that have been brought to the table that are going to make things like this, when they happen, a little bit more problematic and troublesome. You know, now that they feel like they have even more of a voice. I saw a statement yesterday. They're demanding that California go to all synthetic tracks.
I've seen that movie before.
We have, you know, and so it's, look, man, it's not good. It's not fun. I'm just hoping that the industry leaders will somehow find a way to kind of come together and come up with a plan to kind of try to get out of this. I know that's a little bit of a nerve wracking statement asking for them to all work together, but I'm hopeful that in this time of like immense need, they'll kind of find a way to dig down deep and try to find a way to work together.
Do you have any ideas specifically, and we haven't talked about this off air, so I'm totally putting you on the spot, any ideas specifically of the kinds of things that you could see doing to help? I worry that we're in a PR crisis here where the genie's out of the bottle, where anytime something goes wrong, you're going to be in the crawl on ESPN. And again, you're never going to get a situation where you have zero equine fatalities in California for a year, or the kind of thing that might get the attention not paid to this again. It's I do think the genie in the bottle analogy is fair, but do you think there are things, meaningful changes that could occur that could help this when you talk about the governing bodies of the sport?
I think they're trying to do things that are going to reduce the cost, you know, reduce those things happening. But no, I don't believe there's really much left to be done. I mean, not much left. I'm just saying, you know, look, they're working to get the race day medication situation sorted out, where we don't have horses that are running that are unfit. More accountability for the trainers and the owners, I think would be a step that can help with making sure that we have sound horses on the racetrack. I think the situation yesterday is a little bit different, considering that it happened at the dirt crossing coming down the downhill turf course. I've watched a lot of downhill turf course racing, and you know, there is something to be said about that transition. So maybe they need to take a look at that. I mean, you just got to look at everything. But no, all eyes are on us. And, you know, Jeremy Ballin wrote a piece, I think, actually, ironically, if that's the right use of the term, maybe yesterday he released a piece saying, like, what you know, this is all fine, but like, what's going to happen when a horse breaks down? Because it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it happened to come true a little bit sooner than I think we all would have liked. And the worst part about it, Pete, is like, it's probably going to happen in the next 14 days again.
Yeah.
It just probably is. So like we talked about before, I don't know the answer to what is an acceptable amount of equine death. I mean, I think one is too many, but it's inevitable. So how do we work backwards from that to try to reduce it, to get it as close to zero as possible?
Yeah, we're also just in an absolute PR crisis. I just can't believe that appeared on the crawl on ESPN last night. You're going to knock me over with a feather. The level of scrutiny, it's going to be very hard for the sport to hold it up. It would be, again, I mean, I'll go back to the pet analogy. I'm sure there's all kinds of horrible stats you could find about pet ownership that would make people think twice before supporting the pet ownership industry if they weren't already involved. It's a very complicated relationship that we have with animals, and I know I'm a real animal lover, and you know, I have some sympathy for the point of view. I have a lot of sympathy for the basic instinct of the point of view of people who want to make the world better for animals and who view animals' rights almost like people's rights. I don't go all the way there, but I have sympathy for the point of view. I can say that very honestly. But the other huge problem is that none of these folks want to acknowledge is that if PETA had their way and racing were banned tomorrow, one of the first byproducts of that is, and this is a good use of ironically, going to be thousands and thousands of dead animals, because there ain't going to be a place to put all the ones who've been bred to do this. These horses they're bred to race. I have no question we can do a better job taking care of them during and especially after their racing careers are over. But it ain't like there's a home for everyone, not dissimilar to tie it back to the dogs and cats, to the way it is with pets. All right, I think we've put enough on that. I'm sure we're going to be talking about it again. And, you know, I hope folks, I mean, it's ugly, and I hope folks don't get too upset hearing about it. But, you know, this is important stuff that we need to be thinking about and reacting to and prepared to talk to people in the outside world about, too, because unfortunately, as you said, the eyes of the world are on us at this point. Okay, why don't we go back and talk about some racing stuff from this weekend. Let's start with the Florida Derby, JK.
Yeah, you know, obviously a race that has caused some conversation and created some conversation and some debate over tactics, I think. I think a lot of people are questioning or are wondering about the ride that Javier gave on the favorite Hidden Scroll. Who didn't run all that well. So, you know, calm down, everyone. Everyone wants to get worked up because he finished kind of, you know, I don't know what he's fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth or whatever. But I think the important thing to understand when it comes to that situation is, and I tried to say it as best as I could in a tweet, is, look, I give Javier some blame. You know, I think that that professional athletes are going to make mistakes, and that's it's you're allowed to make mistakes, but as fans and supporters of it, we're allowed to comment on those mistakes as long as we do it with, you know, within respect and, you know, not attacking your family or you as a human being. I think it was a poor ride by Javier. I think Javier is a better rider than me and a better rider than most. So I'm not trying to like knock him. I just think that there was a mistake made there. And the mistake that I see that often happens, and that mistake is the idea that when you have a speed horse, going slower early is going to help that horse finish. And I couldn't disagree with that more. And I blame that. I blame when jockeys make those mistakes, whether too fast or too slow. I'll give too slow. Whether it's too slow, they're far back too slow, or on the front end too slow. Those things happen because of the knee-jerk reaction of fans and trainers attacking riders for being aggressive, like Joel Rosario was attacked for what he did in the Fountain of Youth.
I think that's a fair comment. This was a situation to me where I don't think it was rider error as much as my gut tells me this was by design from Connections, who I think were not as concerned with getting the points and getting to the Kentucky Derby as they were with trying to teach the horse a new dimension or something. Now, I hate the decision. It was obviously terrible tactics, frankly. It was a slow pace this time. The horse is wrangled back, ends up running up other horses' behinds for half a mile. You know me, I am the biggest Bill Mott fan in the world, close to it. I'm sure there are a few who, you know, have horses with him and such who could take that mantle from me. But in terms of just horse players, there's nobody I respect more than him. And I was just, my palm was hitting my forehead listening to the post-race comments about how well the horse was traveling and all this. I didn't think the horse particularly ever looked comfortable. I mean, he did end up in a spot where if he was as good as Arrogate, would have finished and won. But, you know, that's a lot to expect of a horse in his third career start. There's no question he still had a chance after that, but there's also no question to me he didn't get to show how good he was, and he was not given his best chance to succeed in this spot. For me, obviously, the Derby, it ain't going to work out now. You won't be able to get the points. If they just awarded horses based on likelihood of winning, I'd still think he'd be an interesting long shot going forward. It sounds like the plan now is to cut back. I don't get it, JK. I wish this horse had a chance to go long and just use his speed. The brilliance he showed in the early fractions he set on the second day and what he did on the first day. Yeah, I get it. It was slop, but the figure was so fast and there was so much against him for him to run that big. This is a horse we haven't, he's not a super horse, but we still haven't scratched the ability, in my opinion, of how good he can be. Agree or disagree?
No, I completely agree. I said yesterday, I don't think we've seen his real race yet. We don't know what he is. He's had two terrible kind of trips in the last two races, and then he had the sloppy performance on debut. You don't know what he is. But like you said a couple of things, got a couple of thoughts. You said something about if he was good enough from that spot, he could have won. And that's true. If he was good enough.
He was a super horse. You know, I mean, if he was like I think of Arrogate in the Dubai World Cup. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, talk about a horse that had every excuse to pack it in and still won. You know, they can do it, but it's a lot to ask.
But here's the thing, though. Arrogate was like Aaron Rodgers, right? He could run, he could beat you with his legs, his arm, with accuracy, with the big ball, with his brain. He was a complete racehorse that could do so many things. That's why he was great, i.e. Aaron Rodgers. But what you're dealing with a horse like Hidden Scroll is someone who's a little bit more one-dimensional, okay? Maybe a little bit more Tom Brady, where he's not going to beat you with his legs. He's going to only beat you with two or three or four things, and he's really stinking good at those two or three or four things. But if you ask Tom Brady to run quarterback draw 17 times a game, he's not going to win. And that's what they were doing. They were asking Hidden Scroll to be something that he's not, and that's the problem that I see with the situation. That's not his strength. Now, I talked to Nick Tamro yesterday, and this it was his. He had some great insight on this idea, and it's something that we definitely remind him we need to have him on the show more. But he made a baseball analogy to what they were trying to do if that was the instructions to try to teach him to rate.
Which I think they must have been. We've seen Javier give too many rides in similar situations. Don't you think it just felt like riding to instructions?
It felt like it. And to Nick's point, it was that, I'm not a baseball guy, but, you know, there's like that one game playoff to get into the playoff thing Yes. that they have sometimes. It's like it's like not pitching your ace then because you want to have him for the playoffs.
Yeah.
There is no playoffs, big fella. There is no derby if you don't run your race today.
Correct.
And that's what happened. There is no derby. So they pitched their third guy because they wanted to keep their ace. And now they won't be.
Now they're going fishing in October.
Exactly.
Oh, that's pretty good, actually. I dig that. Nick is he's a sharp fellow. We do have to have him on here more. Lots else to unpack from the race. I mean, it's tough, right? As sporting fans, I'll wheel in the Dubai World Cup here a little when I talk about maximum security. As bettors, we see Thunder Snow's Dubai World Cup. And as a fan and as a bettor, I just see it two totally different ways. As a fan, wow, that's awesome. This horse with his star-crossed derby, who's a Group 1 winner, I think, on turf, who now has won two Dubai World Cups. That, as a sporting fan, like, that's just awesome. Who wouldn't love to write that story from a narrative point of view? That's my fan hat. And then you put on your bettor hat. And you look at the ridiculous track bias and the other favorite speed horse not breaking that led to the Dubai World Cup 12 months ago. And you look at this one where you had a couple of inexplicable no-shows. And, I mean, circumstances really conspiring to make him... I mean, I'm not saying he didn't deserve the win. But as somebody who's looking to make the bet next time, did he, like... really impress? No. I feel like in a lot of ways he had it handed to him on a silver platter. Now, there are a lot of people, the way this typically goes is the people with that second point of view, the sort of more cynical handicapper point of view, make so much noise on Twitter about how fortunate the horse was that they really upset the fans. And I don't want to do that. I want to acknowledge that the fans, from a fan point of view, have a great story to root for and a cool horse. Not many horses have the talent, even with circumstances in their favor, to win two Dubai World Cups. Nobody's ever done it before, just as one little piece of evidence of that. So it's great, and give him his props as an equine athlete. As a bettor, I'm not interested the next time. And that brings us back to maximum security. You want to talk about having a race handed to you on a silver platter? How about your main competition just decides, we're not going to go for the lead today. Let's pull back. Let's run up other horses behind for the first 6 furlongs of the race. And let's let this other horse waltz on the lead untested and win. I can't wait to bet against maximum security the next day. JK, your thoughts.
Well, I really want to see. I'm very curious, and obviously it'll happen quite a bit in the lead up to the Kentucky Derby. I want to see how many different ways Jason Service is going to answer the question, why did you run this horse for $16,000 on debut? Because I heard somewhere that, you know, I don't want to say what I heard, but I just want to hear, like, what, you know, was he like a sore horse? Did he not seem right? Did he have an issue? At what point did you decide you want to run the horse for 16? The other thing that I brought up is I'm not 100% sure that this horse is that he's fooled anyone that he's like going to win the Kentucky Derby. And let's not forget that he's got the same ownership group as Game Winner. So there's an opportunity there for some gamesmanship that could take place on the first Saturday in May with a horse that has some tactical speed that could be Ford that I think would need a bus ticket to get a mile and a quarter.
Are you implying that you think he could be used as a little bit of a de facto rabbit for Game Winner potentially?
Absolutely. I mean, look, just sometimes if you take a deep breath and you put yourself in a situation, you know, you can realize what someone else might do. And if I had those two horses, I would say, look, I want maximum security to be ridden as if he's going to be loose on the lead. And I want him to try to get to the front end and try to wire the field or be best of speed. He's not going to win in a mile and a quarter race against 20 horses being rated and trying to finish and pass horses and then hold off closers. It's just not going to happen. So let's put him in the race. Let's go 46 and change. Let's know that we're getting some pace in front of us. We'll take game winner back, make one run. He wants to run all day, and he'll come rolling down the middle of a track that he's proven to like.
It does make a lot of sense. Now, when you look at this race, the old school handicapper in me sees maximum security winning the horse that was entered that you could have bought for 16 dimes, you know, fairly recently. And you see the maiden second and you say, ugh, what terrible form this race is going to have. But the more I look at it, JK, and the flow handicapper that I've become, I see a couple of horses in here I might be interested in. And at the top of the list is Code of Honor. And it just gets back to that idea of the way that pace can mask what the final results of a race are. And Code of Honor rallying into the dawdle, already in good position with his Derby points to potentially use this race as more of a prep than a be cranked up and try to have to win to get in the big race. That wasn't the situation. This could have been a true prep for a trainer in Shug McGahee who knows how to use a prep to get a horse ready for a big race. He's going to very likely, though we'll see, but it is very likely in a 20 horse field, is going to see the opposite pace scenario. I have not looked at the Timeform US coding in the chart, but I'm going to assume this was an all blue, and I'm going to assume that the Kentucky Derby is going to be an all red. Code of Honor, maybe a little bit under the radar, chance to run really big for me in the Kentucky Derby. He's the one I want out of it, but I think you could probably make that case about a few of the closers. For you, JK, leaving Hidden Scroll aside, because he will not be competing, who's the horse out of the Florida Derby that you want as of now in the Kentucky Derby? We won't make you have this be your final answer. We'll be doing a final answers podcast at some point about the Kentucky Derby. But as of now, who do you want from here?
So you have two choices. You have a choice, like you mentioned, to think of it as it was a slow-paced race, and there is horses that were trying to close into a slow pace. Or you can say you can have a variation of our friend Mike Maloney's statement that you have in the book Betting with an Edge. There is no trips in bad races.
Slow races.
So I just think it was a slow race. And I just don't think that, like, cause I didn't like Bourbon War or Code of Honor. And the fact that they ran third and fourth with an 80-1 that chased a former 16 claimer. I don't want any of the horses out of that race. That's my initial thought. That could change. But as of right now, I don't want any of them.
That's,
I think, Code of Honor will be a huge sucker play. He'll be a wise guy play. He's the type of horse that's going to go off at 8-1, 10-1, 12-1, and he should be 15-20, 25-1 in that race. That's just my prediction of how it's going to all unfold. I think he'll be a wise guy horse.
We'll see who shows up and what the price is in the end. But, I mean, my gut is that 8-10 sounds okay. I mean, I don't know. I guess it all depends on what happens next weekend. But, and it's not like I'm interested in taking 8-10 right now in the future on him. I wonder if the opportunity might come sooner rather than later for those with the ability, as many of the listeners are. I've been looking at the numbers. We've picked up plenty of UK and Irish listeners from my recent work over on Sky and also on the Final Furlong podcast, Sky Sports Racing, that is. Those people who have the ability to bet now, take a look at what's going on with Code of Honor. The opportunity might be now before any of that wise guy-ness gets into the pool. And it's just another reminder to me, JK, of how much better fixed odds betting is than this parimutuel stuff. There's just so many situations where, and I mean, it was very similar to what we talked about with Colefront on the last podcast. I'm on Final Furlong advising him people are getting 9-1. That morning, he's 8-1. People are actually able to get money down at these numbers. Even in the end on Betfair, he goes into 4-1. That is a lot better than the 5-2 you were worried about him being, and were correct in tote betting about him being. He did go off at exactly 5-2, a fat 5-2, 780 he ended up paying. And I'm going to just have to ask you, JK, since when do you turn up your nose at 5-2 on an easy winner?
Oh, I'll never turn my nose at a 5-2. I barely turn my nose at a 4-5. My problem there was just the way that those pools are designed. I knew the horse was going to be in quote-unquote overbet. And I've tried to have this conversation with other players recently. Like, hindsight is great, but don't act as if you're smarter than you thought you were after you know the result, right? Like, I still believe that he was overbet. Yes, he won, but it wasn't like he won easily. And I just felt like there was going to be other value on other horses in that style of pool where the American horses are often overbet.
I'll tell you, I've noticed this, and this is really for the UK Irish listeners, but the international markets are underrating these USA horses in dirt races. We were able to take advantage of it with some nice each-way hits in the plays we talked about on Final Furlong, as well as those winners, including the one that that JK was too stuck up to bet.
Hey, did you see the video of Todd watching the race, though?
Yeah, that was cool. That was
very
really cool.
Fun. Very fun watching someone who's won so many big races still have one low. He still went right-handed one good time. Wouldn't be in trouble in any jurisdiction.
We should also mention, and frankly, you get some credit for this, but really we're going to deflect all the credit to our man, Frank McGoey, who put Plouqué Parfait on our radar earlier this winter, scoring at 15-1, even in the toad pool in the UAE Derby. That winner, by the way, JK, closed 26-1 on Betfair. Another example of exchanges and fixed odds and the wonderful things they do for the horse player. But great job by you in remembering that one and bringing the goods on the podcast. As we've said many times, you can't stop rock and roll and you can't stop the In the Money Players podcast.
That's an old handicapping thing that I kind of picked up probably in like 2015, where I really like learned about surrounding yourself with smart people and remembering the things that they say. And that was a situation where I remembered that Frank liked the horse, and he liked the horse off training, off of trips, and all of these things. And it's when you surround yourself with smart people that have good opinions, sometimes those opinions can blindly lead you to good opportunities. It's something that I think I probably picked up like Saratoga, right? Where like you hear about the next best thing, but he gets beat and he gets beat again. And then he's trying something new. And everyone forgot that at one time he was this talented, well thought of horse. And then they come back around and they win at a price that sometimes can be ignored. I think Avery Island's actually an example of that. Horse won a one turn mile race, I think, at Aqueduct after being the quote unquote best Kieran 2 year old and didn't do anything at Saratoga, came back and won at a pretty nice price later in the year.
Eventual graded stakes winner, too. That information was correct. The horse just wasn't going to do his best running 6 furlongs, needed that extra ground. And I agree, this is why horse-to-watch lists are such a good thing. There are several places online where you can set up your own sort of stable male horse-to-watch list, whatever you want to call it. All right, we are not doing a full-length show today. We're going to go about 45 minutes because we've got so much content coming down the pike this week. We're going to go with the Keeneland Select Players Podcast. That's what we're going to call those, it sounds ridiculous, but semi-daily shows. They're not really daily, but they're going to be extra shows only focusing on Keeneland. We'll do 2 of those a week in addition to our 2 main flagship In the Money Players Podcast. That means there are going to be 4 podcasts appearing in our feed for the Keeneland meeting. We encourage you fully to dive into the Keeneland content, but it's not like if you're somebody who just doesn't have the time or whatever, you can stick with the flagship shows and you're going to get all the highlights. But if you really want all the nitty-gritty, all the winners, all the best information about what's going on at Keeneland, you're going to want to listen to those Keeneland Select Players podcasts. That still leaves us a few minutes, JK, to do a little bit of Ask ITM. How about this one? We talked about baseball before. We just had baseball opening day. We bring in a little baseball here. Nick wants to know, Pete Rose only bet in support of his own team. He didn't bet every game, the implication being when he didn't wager on them, they were more likely to lose. should a horse owner be allowed to wager on or against their horse? Should this information be known to the public? I'll let you take a swing at that one.
Well, I get the question. And, you know, I played in a contest before where a gentleman hit a horse that he had and hit the horse big. I don't so much have a problem with it. Maybe in the contest setting, I like what they do. You have to, you know, announce, you know, if you have ownership in a horse, and you have to either bet on that horse or you have to pass on the race. So I kind of like that. I think it's probably too hard to try to police in terms of doing it and out in the open with just a regular parimutuel situation. Because look, I'll just have my cousin or my nephew or my housekeeper or my whatever, you know, do the betting for me. I don't think it matters enough to make a difference.
Fair enough. I do get the idea. And I don't think you're technically, isn't there some rule with trainers, and it might apply to owners too, that you can technically, again, enforceability aside, only bet on your horse in the win position parimutuelly, at least in some states. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Heard of it. I've heard of it. And like I said, I don't have a problem with it. Because here's the thing. Here's the secret. And I hate to ruin it for everyone. The trainers, the owners, and the jockeys, they don't know either.
Are you getting into it? Was this old expression was mentioned to me the other day on Twitter, not to me, but thrown out there in the world on Twitter by Dave Gutfreund about our friend, our mutual friend, the late, great Jeff Sotman, whose phrase, whenever the steam horse went down or whatever accepted knowledge was the lie was put to the accepted knowledge, nobody knows nothing. And I think that does sum it up a lot of times. And that gets to another question we had, JK, and we talked about this a little bit the other day, but about maiden races and whether or not this comes up in contests a lot, the idea that maiden races are somehow these tremendous benefits run for insiders. Do you buy that idea at all?
I think there's definitely an edge to know what people are thinking, to know what people who are spending a lot of time around the barns, a lot of time on the backs of the horses, a lot of times training the horses, they have more information than you and I have. It doesn't mean they're always right, but I will always want to go into a maiden race, you know, especially the high profile one, with people's opinion on their horse. Not much, needs longer, needs grass, missed a work. You know, didn't get to gallop him because he had this, but we need to get it started him because we got to have him ready for team. These are things that I want to know, and I don't care what anyone says. You're better off having that information. It's how you process the information that can lead down good or bad paths. So I don't think it's an insider's game. I think there's a lot more information to be gathered and a lot less reliable information at that.
And there's different kinds of insiders. I'm super interested in what professional clockers have to say. When it comes to horsemen, I agree. I like to hear what they have to say, note what they have to say for future reference. But I think it is 100% correct to say you will go broke blindly betting the so-called inside information from horses.
Right. But here's one thing I will say, right? A specific trainer had two horses in at Gulfstream on Saturday. One of them was the looked like on paper, like couldn't lose, but I just didn't trust the horse. I was nervous about so-and-so. So when that trainer sent the message to a mutual friend and said, I trust this one, or yes to this one, I don't trust the other one. By him not saying that there was a trust issue with the one that I was having the trust issue with was enough for me to kind of lean on that opinion that I had created from a handicapping standpoint only. I just wanted to make sure that all systems were go.
You're also very good. One of your strengths is that ability to synthesize a lot of information. A lot of people aren't able to do that. If they start hearing information and then they want to throw out everything that they did themselves and just go with the information. That latter approach, much, much bigger problem than your former approach where you're taking that info and sort of incorporating into what you were doing anyway, and then the way that you write bets too. You're using it not necessarily to put a horse in or take a horse out, but you're using it to determine how much to bet that horse. It reminds me, we talked before about Mike Maloney. He'll be joining us in downtown Lexington on Friday night for this event at Bell's. Going to be a lot of fun. But he has the great line in Betting with an Edge that he'll always want to include these tipped horses in races where he, essentially like meaning in races where he's spreading anyway, but you do not want to press them. Don't take that touted Wesley Ward first time starter and single, but don't be a hero and try to eliminate if you have a smart way to bet it anyway, where you can include the horse and that information might just have some signal in it. I think that's the right way to fly at the end of the day when it comes to the so-called inside information.
If you can take information, negative information on the first or second choice, and you can build around not using that horse, you'll be shocked how much equity you end up having on that ticket by not using that horse. It's tremendous. It's tremendously powerful if you can withstand the times where they tell you no and the thing runs anyways. You have to be prepared for that.
That happens frequently, but I will say this, in equity terms, in my life anyway, and then we'll get if you agree or disagree, I have done better on information in my lifetime where I got negative supposed inside information about a horse than where I got positive. Positive inside information, also you start filtering the sources. You will occasionally find a source that's really good, but I would say of the positive inside information that I hear, I'm going to go so far as to say 80% of it, 75% of it maybe, is useless. Like, and I think part of that is the trainer likes the horse, but a lot of times a trainer won't be able to sort of see beyond the end of his own shed row, won't necessarily know what else is in the race. I mean, I hope I don't sound too patronizing and insulting here. I don't mean it that way. Trainers have a very different, very important job. They shouldn't be worrying about stuff from a handicapping point of view necessarily. They've got other fish to fry. So I don't mean this to be judgy. I just mean that information, for whatever it means, for whatever it's worth, it doesn't necessarily help me. In fact, it might actively hurt me from the handicapping side. The negative horses, those anti-touts, they will win. You had one recently with a Navarro horse, I remember, taking you out of something big, JK. But on balance, I do find them more valuable. How about you?
Yeah, the negatives are definitely more powerful than the positives. But, you know, the positives are just great to use as a tiebreaker, right? If you're trying to decide, am I going to use this horse? I kind of don't want to. I like to look for if I don't want to use a horse, I try to look for anything negative to push me over the edge of having the courage to leave the horse off. Yeah, like for instance, you know, there's a horse, it's like, you know, 10 to 1, you know, and I think he can run, but I also don't want to waste money on him if he's not going to run. So let me find out. And then you text and you get a text that says, really worried about the outside post, doesn't break well, and, you know, probably needs cover. that's just enough for me to get off the 10 to 1 shot that I was on the fence about anyways. You can't take it too seriously, and you can't ignore it too much.
All right, I have one more point to make that ties back several of the things we've been talking about. We talked about the Bill Mott reaction to the Hidden Scroll race. We've talked a couple of times about Mike Maloney and betting with an edge. By the way, when I got back from England, I had two giant new cases of Betting with an Edge books upstairs. I'll bring some of them on Friday night. Folks who haven't read it, please send me a tweet. Send me an email through the site. If you want a copy, we will get you a copy. Best to buy it directly from me at this point. That would be much appreciated. But Mike also tells a story in there about meeting at a bar or something, just in a social encounter, getting to have a deep racing conversation with a Hall of Fame trainer who was like completely unaware of a track bias that had been dictating the outcome of races on the card. He was puzzled by why a horse ran so bad that was three wide on all the way around on a golden rail, that type of thing. Again, they're very different jobs, and we don't say this stuff to denigrate them. They're doing something very different than what we're doing. We can respect it. We can take what we need from it, but if it came down to a handicapping contest, you give me a bunch of Hall of Fame trainers and let me pick my team of horse players. Horse players are going to beat them senseless like a drum.
It's just a different, like you said, it's comparing apples to oranges. It's a different deal. You know, I would compare it to like a basketball coach, you know, trying to tell you who to bet on in a basketball game. It's, they can give you insight about their team. They can give you insight, but they can't tell you if -7 at 100 and -140 juice is a problem or not. So there's it's just a different ball game that we're all playing.
And it works both ways. At the same time, you could give me a really great horse player, and you know, as I joke to you, JK, you work on the backstretch for 2 days, you're gonna get kicked inside of an hour, you know, and it's the same for me. It's very different, skill sets on offer. And the other example I always think of with this stuff is the idea that just because you know how to build the plane doesn't mean you know how to fly it. It's they're related. There might be insight from one field to another, but they're just very different enterprises, and it's a mistake to expect one to be the other. Do you have a closing thought for this episode of the In the Money Players podcast, JK?
Well, we started with some Cali talk, and I want to point out a couple things in California that I thought we did good, but more to celebrate one of our friends of the show. But River Boyne was a play against based on LASIK situation. I don't know if it was a LASIK that caused the horse to run like he did, but our friend Mike McCarthy with another grade one win with Ohio out there in the Frank Kilroy Mile. We were happy to see that. And then also St. Joe Bay was another podcast horse, and I didn't even get to participate in. I was, you know, running around. I was in Chicago. I had Austin. I was playing in the contest, and that race wasn't involved in the contest, and I completely missed St. Joe Bay, who paid like 30-something bucks.
Those were good shout-outs to give, and again, we had a nice little go on the pod. Speaking of Hawthorne, props to Frank Mustari, sire of Justin Mustari from the World Horse Players Tour show, who got the win. We'll send out info when that TV show gets produced and uploaded somewhere online. I'm curious to watch and check that out. Did you see any of the TV production stuff? Were you privy to any of that? Did you get any screen time, JK?
I was in the mix. Yeah, I got a good one-liner in. I said, to ask, you know, who are you scared of? I said, any guy with a last name Mustari.
Pretty good and prophetic, as it turned out, with Frank's big win. I've never written about him. It would be fun to see if I can pick up an assignment somewhere to do a review of that. My pro bono contest writing days are probably over with as busy as we are with this show. And that busyness is going to include two extra shows and a live show this week. When will we come back? Wednesday, will we put out the first edition of the Keeneland Select Players podcast? That work for you?
Pete, I'm just living in your world, baby. You tell me.
There you go. Wednesday, we'll do a show. We'll preview the meet a little bit. We will talk a little Thursday and Friday at Keeneland. We'll come back on Thursday with the regular weekend show. Friday, we'll do a show, or at least post a show, covering Sunday Keeneland and Friday night at Bell's. Come join us after the races, approximately 6:45, 7 o'clock. We're just going to head down there when things finish up at Keeneland, and we will go from there. And that's it for this edition of the In the Money Players podcast. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank our friends once again at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. The important work they're doing, there's never been a better time to support an organization like that. If you give through our link with them, we get the credit. That's a way you can really help the show. We're going to be learning a lot more about the great work at TRF over the coming months. TRFinc.org/players. You guys have done a great job with donations so far. We want you to keep those donations coming in throughout the Triple Crown season and throughout the year. Also want to thank our friends at 10 Strike Racing for their continued support. Have to get Marshall back on here soon. That'll be a lot of fun. Going to see them on Arkansas Derby weekend. I'll be out there guest lecturing at Marshall's class and then heading out to the 10 Strike party. Really looking forward to hanging out with the Burkett clan and everybody else out at Hot Springs. We will be back on Wednesday. Just one more reminder, this podcast has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Coatney. We are going to see you real soon. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. Hello and welcome. This is, I forgot the opening to my own show.